Welcome to First Up. I'm your host, Brian White. And in today's episode, I am joined by Maggie Espinoza, a psychotherapist, to discuss the unique ways in which people heal from trauma, as well as supporting students through therapy while propelling them towards their future. Welcome to First Up. I'm joined by Maggie Espinoza. Maggie, do you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, my name is Margaret Espinoza, but I go by Maggie. I am a licensed clinical professional counselor, certified integrative medicine, and certified clinical trauma professional. That's all my alphabet soup.
And then were you a first-generation college student?
I was a first-generation college student, yes.
Okay, when did you first learn of the term first-generation?
So I recently learned that it's mostly being used right now for first-generation college students, because when I was growing up, first-generation just kind of meant you're first-generation here. So I would say fairly recently.
And then what was your transition like from high school to college?
My transition was kind of weird in the sense that I went from Lincoln Park High School, which it's set up like a hierarchy based on like academics or how you test in. So in some senses, you can become a big fish in a little pond. And when I transitioned to college, there were a lot of big fishes in a big pond. So you're no longer the smart one, the one that gets by, the one who has like a lot of visibility with teachers. It was like having to find my way of what teachers do I get extra work from or extra attention to get something completed or learn something from. So yeah, I would say it was a tough transition. And tougher more so, I guess, because I think being a second born, I saw my brother go through high school and what that was like for him. But I didn't have anyone to learn from what college was going to be like, just like what you saw on TV.
Yeah, you mentioned that your parents came here. Where are you from? Where are your parents from?
So my parents are originally from Mexico and I was born here.
And would you say that they were a big support for you going through college, or would you say that was mostly your brother because he got to experience that first?
So I don't think my family like anecdotally understood what college and academics and education would give you. But I think as far as my older brother, you know, he had success just out of high school with business stuff himself and didn't go get a college degree. So for him, I guess it was more so like, you can excel without a college degree, but I knew that what I wanted to do required much more than just the college degree, but college was like my biggest first step. So I think a lot of times we might think that people have immense family support, which we do, but support for what everyone needs might look a little different.
It's interesting that you mentioned that your brother didn't feel like he needed to go to college, but you said you did. When did you first realize that you wanted to study therapy or go into therapy?
I think I always wanted to be in some kind of helping profession. But a lot of high school was like, I knew what I wanted to be. I just didn't always know the steps to get there. So I had to ask a lot of the adults around me that to me appeared successful or happy in their jobs. Like, how did they get there? And like everyone else will tell you, they had the psych class in high school and that's what led them to that. But the psych class for me in high school left me craving more and saying like, oh, I really want to do this, but I want to be on the research end of things. I want to learn how we can impact people systemically and not just only like one application of me teaching you. I think also when we think about the mental health space, I felt like I knew I had a unique voice as to what I can do within this space, because any famous psychiatrist, psychologist, therapist, they're white. So I think that speaks to a different way that you provide services, understand people. And me coming from like an immigrant background, Latino in particular, Spanish speaking, I felt like that's often a service that gets neglected and of people that might not get heard or get the service that they need. And I knew that from being a little kid myself and going to medical clinics, where oftentimes the first interaction that you might have with the mental health system might be at like a place where I work at, a federally qualified mental health clinic, where someone's checking in on like, are you depressed? Are you anxious? What do you have going on? Like, how else can we support you? the system, it wasn't just checking for like how you're doing physically, but also asking about your emotional well-being. I think just being able to see like how community health does support people, and then that's supporting our community, the health of others in different ways. I feel like I wanted to be part of that.
And what you said sticks with me, because at an early age, you were able to see that there was a misrepresentation of people that are helping other people. We don't usually see a lot of other people of color in those positions. So you noticing that early on is pretty impressive. And I feel like you definitely belong where you are now.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I think, you know, just also like being a really young kid, you learn to be an advocate for your parents, because sometimes like my mom didn't speak English. So I had to be the person to ask the question, understand something, reinterpret something, infer for someone else. I think those experiences also shaped me into not only the profession I have, but just partly who I am as a human, which makes me maybe more apt to the position or the role.
I agree for sure. And then without getting into any personal information or stories about your patients, how has your experience been as a therapist?
There's good days, right? And then there's sometimes sad days. I can't say that anyone comes, I don't want to say that they don't come to see you when they're happy, but it's less likely that they're coming to see you when they're happy. It's usually when someone is undergoing some level of distress, someone has passed away, they're not getting support from the person they expected to. They're going through a divorce, a death in the family. Right now, I'm seeing quite a bit of like refugees that are coming in from Central America, South America, and a lot of trauma. So I'd say that there are days that it leaves me with like a sweater of sadness, for lack of better words. But there are days that, I don't know, you hear someone's tone of voice change, or, you know, they're feeling a little bit more confident or engaging in something that allows them to love themselves. And I think that's really beautiful to me. So it makes it worthwhile.
You mentioned a lot of, I don't want to say sadness, but a lot of your patients do come in with those emotions. What kind of toll does that put on you?
Oh, goodness. Kind of a tough one. They don't teach us that in school. They teach you a lot of theory, and they teach you how to talk to someone and what to do. And we preach a lot about self-care, this mm-hmm. term, but I think it's sometimes really hard for you to recognize the need of that yourself, right? And what that looks like for you, because it's very individualistic. I think for me, I really require a lot of routine. I need to be able to wake up and have a slow morning, get my mind straight for the day, enjoy small pleasures during the day, a cup of warm coffee, a not very stimulating, but stimulating show, walks with the dog, maybe some, you know, fitness during the day. I think that's definitely what I need.
Just out of curiosity, are you familiar with the term weathering?
No. Can you explain it to me a little bit?
So Dr. Arlene Geronimus, she coined the term around, I think, 1992 or so. But it's pretty much a term that she's used for the last 40 years, just describing those effects of the systematic oppression on marginalized peoples and their bodies. And it breaks down even to a cellular level. So the reason I asked you is because you deal with a lot of trauma from your patients. Are you feeling, or do you ever feel, a sense of that weathering just from the systems of oppression, from the world, and then listening to other people and empathizing with them? Do you feel that?
I think the term that you're using, it absolutely does have a lot of biological factors. The mind and body is very much interconnected. I think a lot of times people, again, use mental health to be like, oh, this is just stuff that's going on in your head. And your medical doctor is just like, oh, there's something going on with your stomach. But like the stress that we experience environmentally, the stress that we experience, you know, emotionally, definitely impacts what I generate, you know, the hormones I generate in my body, neurochemicals, and how my heart is going to function, my stress levels, my breathing patterns, brain development, even like neuroplasticity for adults, like everything is so interconnected. So weathering, this terminology, is very much true, right? Mm. I would say for myself, I have experienced in this field some level of hardening, I'd say. again, my personal experience, I can't say that this is like for every therapist, right? But there is a level of like, you can become jaded about like your perspective into the world, and maybe sometimes view the world as it being unsafe too, because of the things that you hear that can occur, have occurred to someone. Some of the things you hear from people, you would think that it would have to be written in like a fiction novel, you know? So I think my way of preserving myself is definitely maintaining routine, maintaining kindness, compassion, relationships around me that support me to be able to do this job. For me to be able to support others, I also need to be supported. Sometimes that does unfortunately mean having to cut certain activities out, certain people off. And it's not for the lack of like wanting connection, but it's almost trying to be like this warrior of peace sometimes. Like sometimes I have to fight for myself to have peace. And sometimes that means saying no to a 3 a.m. on a Saturday night going out, and instead go home and be in bed by like 10 p.m. so that I can wake up in the morning, do some yoga, go on a walk with the dog, read a book.
In a way, you find ways to just bring yourself back to reality. Because with the hardening, I know that you have to do that to continue on with your job and be there and listen to all of the people that come see you. But you have ways that you use to ground yourself and reset every day.
I would say so, and I would hope so. I mean, I'm not a perfect person. There are definitely days that I might sit in front of TV and watch Netflix for like a few hours and then ask me if I still am watching. I'm like, how dare you? And other days, it's going to look like having routine. Like I said, activities that seem really mundane, like fitness and going out on walks, sometimes pushing myself to be social, I'd say.
I want to switch gears a little bit here. But what benefits do people gain from entering therapy, and how can we change the negative connotation that some families have towards therapy? I know specifically in African-American community, it's looked at as a bad thing to go to therapy. So just how can we change that negative connotation?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good question. I want to speak from a place of talking about decolonizing things like therapy. I think we often look at this dynamic that services like therapy or going to the doctor typically have, where you have this professional and they're up here and somehow they know more than you. They're abstracting all of these things from you. Like they want to talk about your sadness. They're imposing on you that you had trauma because of a particular incident that occurred. But I call BS on that kind of system, which is why I try to do this work as best I can. Yeah. It's to become like a team with the person I'm working with. I'm not an expert in them. They're an expert in them. I'm here to ask questions. I'm here to talk about the things that you feel are holding you back, to talk about the things that are salient to you right now, and put out this thought that like not everything that we've experienced is trauma. Trauma is relative. Trauma for one person can be that they, you know, got into a car accident and this stayed with them. Trauma for someone else can be losing their best friend in a fight that they had. Trauma is very relative. But for the professional to sit here and say, oh, you experienced the loss of your father, that must have been traumatic for you. But it might not be for that person. Maybe for that person, they need to hear how this person was a chapter in their life and what they learned from this relationship and how it supports them, even though the person's not here. I guess what I don't want people to take from the idea of therapy that it's that this person is going to be taking from you rather than giving to you. That professional relationship that you have with a therapist or counselor, whatever terminology you want to use, should be one that supports you in whatever your goal is to move the needle towards what you want. If what you're wanting to do is just feel supported, happy, have community, then let's talk about those things that are actionable that you can do, that we can find for you, that can get you there. Because I don't want someone to rely on me, and I don't want someone to be stuck, you know, talking about things in the Wayback Machine. I want to do something that's going to help propel someone positively towards their future. I think a lot of old psychology is what is also portrayed in the media that, again, like, we have to talk about all these things from the past. There's over 400 different modalities of therapy, and not one thing is going to fit for someone, and not one thing is going to be the perfect solution. There might be a combination of things that you and a therapist are working to extract that's going to be, you know, like your yellow brick road to get you to the next steps.
And it's interesting too, when you say all that, I think of race-based practice and the medical field as well. It kind of relates to that. Everything is not a one fits all type of thing. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's important to kind of move our civilization and society as a whole towards that point where we are starting to look at people as individual and not just as a race and give everybody a one fits all type of category. So that's important.
Yeah. And like you're saying too, with a lot of minority populations, Latino, African-American, whatever it be, I think a lot of these traditional views on, like I said, old medicine or old therapy practices, the lens is coming from like this American white man perspective. And I think sometimes it can forget that we have to meet our patient where they're at. We have to, they're not just a patient, they're also a person. Right. So we have to take into consideration what is important to them, what their needs are, and relationships are like the hugest thing that you can have for positive supports. Right. So like a huge concept that we get a lot, especially around high school age, college students, it's this need for individuation. Right. American society tells us you're on your own. You're 18. You're able to do whatever you want. You're able to go and do something. But depending on the family structure that you come from, it might pull you towards, why are you leaving us? Because we make decisions together. We move together like a group, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like we have to take culture into consideration hugely, because if not, we can pull from someone to become so individualized that they might feel the need to cut ties with the very thing that might support them, which is their community, whatever that may be. So yeah, hopefully that's something that a lot of Latino therapists are also putting out there, that part of the voice, because we're not trying to remove culture from a professional service. We're hoping that it adds to the perspective.
And you said something that kind of sticks with me, meet people where they're at. And if my co-host was here, Jasmine, she would say it again. So I just want to throw that out there. But yes, absolutely. I feel like we need to meet people where they're at. Even for us in our field, what we do in helping students, first generation students, we try to meet them where they're at, because everyone has a different story. And it's important to hear that story first before you just throw out solutions to problems. So I'm glad you mentioned that. And then just speaking on first generation students in general, from a mental health perspective, what do you think first generation students are carrying with them from day to day?
That's a really broad question. I think a big part could be part of maybe what I was talking to, this perspective, like this interpersonal struggle that we have with ourselves about, like, how much am I branching out on my own to become my own person? And how does that impact like the relationship I have with my community, my family? I think growing up, I did hear a little bit of this idea that if I was going to school, I was pulling from these people. But you didn't hear it in that way of like, oh, you're not one of us. What you hear is the teasing that happens about, you think you're better than us. You think you're smarter than us. You think you're doing these things. But it's like this jokey way that we tell someone, like, I'm kind of nervous that you're becoming something that I might not understand or I might not connect with. I think we have a foot in each world where we're trying to become our own person, but we're also still trying to stay connected to the people around us. And that's really a tough thing to do. I think we carry that with us a little bit, and how we contend with that in an academic space, in a family space. Yeah.
I know we mentioned a little bit of trauma and trying to get away from that, but how does therapy help to heal or alleviate some of those wounds that students or people in general just go through?
I think counseling in and of itself, it's going to be what you're hoping it can be. If you meet with the right person, I'd say too, because every therapist has their own perspective and style and way of being, because we're people too.
Yeah.
But I would hope that what it would be able to provide is just like a safe space for that level of exploration that we're trying to do. If it's to talk about relationships with your family, relationship with yourself, and ways to sometimes be able to even express that. And again, a safe space. I think a lot of times right now, especially with like social media, we spend a lot of time expressing our negative emotion, but we don't often get back the objective response that we might need to get us to move the needle on what our actual goal is. I think sometimes we get someone who feeds the fire rather than helping us guide ourselves to being like this warrior of peace for ourselves. So hopefully that's what counseling is able to provide someone.
Just hearing you speak in terms of giving support to people and helping them achieve what they want to do, I think that's value in itself, one. And I feel like a lot of people around the world lack those supports. You mentioned that even though everyone's going to school, it's not always that family is giving them support. So I think support is important. And I think support is something that everybody should push for, no matter what field you're in. Just like I said before, a lot of the things that you said kind of comes directly over to our side of things in education, how we work with students, how we work with professionals. So I thank you for sharing that. Just from your professional and your personal experience, what do stages of healing and recovery look like? And what could that look like for first-generation students or low-income students or students of color? I know you mentioned it a little bit, but...
Yeah, no. I think that's a really subjective question. It might be different for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. I think the first steps of whatever that may be is just finding the person that you can connect with. And that's it. Just the person you feel safe with. Because healing, it's not like this trajectory that everyone thinks it's very linear.
Yeah.
It's more like a baby stepping step by step. You know, like we're going up a set of stairs and it takes a lot of scaffolding from like the people around us to get us to the next step. We do have to feel trust with the person that we're with so that we can be vulnerable and talk about the things that the voice that's in my head, the record that keeps playing, that sometimes might tell you that you can't do something or you didn't have anyone to show you something, so you're not going to succeed at it, but rather meet with someone who can challenge that voice and teach you how to challenge it for yourself so that when you are having a moment that you're telling yourself, oh, I don't think I can do this, instead it's like, all right, I've had tough times before and I'm going to encounter tough times again. But when I've been in tough times, X, Y, Z were the things that helped me, right? So I think that's the first thing I want to just say, that that's where healing can start, is you being able to have that person that you can have trust with to get you to the next state of like self-acceptance and self-exploration, all that stuff that comes with being a person and having the understanding that we're going to have this rainbow of emotions because it's part of the human condition, rather than the possibility of someone telling you your next steps. It's better for someone to become their own advocate, their own leader.
I think that's important. And you said that healing's not a linear growth type of thing, but I know that there's sometimes setbacks. And like you said, finding those things that help you get to where you want to go, those become more important as you face some of those setbacks. And it's important to just keep pushing and finding what makes you go.
Support's going to look so different for so many people, because I think when we talk about the, like I mentioned earlier, that sometimes you're not getting support. And, you know, I think we all imagine that like family is supposed to be supportive, right? Those people learn how to give support because they learned it from someone else, right? So for support for some people, it might be that they put food on the table and they kept the lights on at the house. And for other people, the support they got is all these positive words and someone came to each of their baseball games or something like that. And by the time we reach like college age, the kind of support that we might need might be different because the people around us may or may not know what is going on in your head, what's going on in your world, especially if you are first gen. I mean, they're not with you on campus. They don't know what's going on day to day. They just see when you come home and they see your head in books and they might see that you're changing, evolving, or whatever. So it's important for us to recognize what we are needing so that we can explain what we need, but also recognize what the wonderful people around us are able to give us and be realistic with it, right? Like sometimes someone is going to show you love by bringing you a nice bowl of warm soup. And that's their way of telling you that they love you and they're supporting you and they're wanting you to just focus, right? But they might not be able to have the emotional intelligence to tell you those things. This is their way of expressing it. I think it's just also recognizing you might need different things, but the people around you are able to give you different things too.
And it's going to look different in different ways depending on the person. So,
yeah.
Well, Maggie, I want to thank you, one, for joining us, and two, for doing the work that you're doing. Like I said before, it's very important work, and I applaud and appreciate the type of work that you're doing, as well as how you go about doing your work and bringing people up and giving them those supports that they need. Like I said, just listening to you today so much relates to what we do here at ISAC and what we try to do, continue to do, when we're trying to help students and families in certain positions, trying to bring them up and support them in all the ways that they need. So looking at people as individuals, that's something I've always tried to do.
Yeah, and I think it's important what you guys do too, because as you help one person, you're not just helping that individual, you're helping their community, because they impact other people and other people are always watching them. So I think it's helpful for us to keep that in perspective when we're like you guys, you're helping one student, but you're really helping potentially their younger sibling, their cousin who's watching them. You know, we all learn by watching and we grow that way.
And that's something I want to keep with me. And it's empowering to hear you talk about it and keep me pushing on the right direction of doing the good work. Thank you again for joining me.
Thank you, guys.
I want to thank Maggie Espinosa again for joining us today. We would like to thank ISAC for supporting us, the First Generation Scholars Network for encouraging us to put this podcast together. Thanks to our producers, Joey Lieberman and Matt Montez. Last but not least, we would like to thank our listeners for tuning in. We hope you'll join us on our next episode. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not directly reflect the opinions of ISAC. We hope you enjoyed the episode and have a good day, everyone.